When Mikhail Khodorkovsky was the CEO of the oil company Yukos, he was the wealthiest man in Russia and one of the wealthiest in the world. But in 2003, he was tried and convicted of tax evasion and has been held since in a Siberian prison. Filmmaker Cyril Tucci joins us to discuss the documentary he has made that chronicles Mr. Khodorkovsky's rise and fall. And also joining us is Mr. Khodorkovsky's son, Pavel Khodorkovsky. And in a few minutes, we will also be joined by Joe Nocera, who has written extensively about the story for the New York Times. The film Khodorkovsky opens today at the Film Forum on West Houston Street, and I'm very pleased to welcome you to our show. Cyril, when did you become interested in the Khodorkovsky story, and how?
Well, I'm usually doing fiction films, and I was invited by Andrei Plakhov, a Russian film critic, to a Siberian festival with my last road movie. And there I found out about the case, about Khodorkovsky, because his oil company was in this area, and he financed the city and also the festival. And at that moment, I wanted to make a fiction film first about Khodorkovsky and his...
Well, it has been covered a lot in the newspapers, the story has, but until I saw this film, I really didn't understand completely what had gone on. Pavel, your father wrote a book called The Man with the Ruble. What was that about?
Well, that was their first try at expressing their thoughts. It was co-authored with my dad's close friend, Leonid Nevzlin. And this was written during the time when they were, you know, just giving their first shot at American-style capitalism in Russia. And, you know, comparing this book with what my father writes today, you can see how he has evolved from, you know, being this very intense businessman to more of a philanthropist.
Well, he began, as he reveals in the book, as a devout communist. What made him change his mind and believe that capitalism was going to be his salvation?
Mostly, I believe, exposure to other countries. And I think that's what's ultimately going to help Russia of today move forward. Because when people go abroad and see how other societies function, they can make their own conclusions and decisions. And that's what happened to my dad.
Although getting involved in business in Russia continues to be a problem, but we'll get into that in a little while. Cyril, how did Khodorkovsky, who grew up under rather modest circumstances and had limited career opportunities because he was Jewish, become one of the richest men in the world?
Well, because I didn't have the chance to have my favorite version of 3.5 hours because of my dramaturg said Cyril, nobody will watch it, I focused on the main conflict of Khodorkovsky and Putin. But we have half an hour about his first money. It's not that easy, but I try it. I try to explain it. He wasn't in the youth organization Komsomol. And there,
so he was a communist. That's a communist youth organization.
I mean, everybody was there, but he was quite active in the Komsomol. And due to Gorbachev's liberalization, there was a possibility to open up the markets, and they had possibilities. And that's how he met also Nevzlin, to kind of like turn the internal like virtual money into real cash. So he was the first who got kind of like the key to open up to the real market. And that's how they got had a quick start or a head start.
Well, he had studied chemistry in school, but yeah. Then he, what you're talking about is when he founded Russia's first private bank, Menatep. Did that grow out of the Komsomol experience?
Even before that, what I know is that when they started with this kind of like offering services to other Komsomol and other institutions and could really make more money than everybody else, because everybody was earning kind of like 180 rubles per month, everybody. Maybe sometimes 185 or 175, but it was very average. And with the Komsomol business to offer services and get real cash, they had very fast revenues and wanted to expand and wanted to have a loan. And then the state bank said, no, we will give only banks a loan. Then they said, okay, we will found a bank. That's how they came to the first bank.
And they were able to found a bank because of the changes at this time. Communism had fallen, and there was a great desire to bring capitalism into the system. How were formerly state-owned Russian businesses priced and sold when they were being privatized, Pavel?
Well, that question often comes up, and I'm actually glad that you've asked this before, because oftentimes people cite the acquisition of Yukos as being unfair.
Because it went for so little when it was worth a lot more.
The thing is that the pricing was due to two factors. A lot of these companies carried a lot of debt on their books, and especially it was payroll debt, which was the most scary because that meant that practically the entire workforce could go on strike. So that was the first reason to why the companies were priced at such a fraction of their perceived real value. For example, Yukos carried almost $2 billion of debt on its books at the time of acquisition.
But, Sarah, you also point out in the film that the Yeltsin government was concerned that if they offered these companies at full price, the only people who could afford them would be foreigners, and then pretty much all of Russia's industry would be owned by foreigners. So they were selling them at kind of fire sale prices to the people who had access to some money?
To access to some money and who were at all capable of doing business. If there's one part in the film where I was visiting Khodorkovsky's former dean, and you could tell that he really didn't understand the logic of capitalism even today. Yeah, he said, "Oh, look, they had advertisement on the cabs," and then Pavel's mother says, "Yeah, it was advertisement. No, it was they're making money," and it was saying as if he would say they are sinners. Yeah, yeah. And so it was. I think they had the head start also because they had the knowledge and invited very early Western advisors how to set up capitalist structures in the country.
Let's bring in Joe Nocera. Hi, Joe. I've just been informed that from now on we will be describing you on the station as a columnist, correspondent for the New York Times, and a contributor to WNYC.
The only thing wrong with that is I am most certainly not a correspondent. I am definitely a columnist. Correspondents do actual work.
But you have covered the Khodorkovsky story when you were doing reporting.
Yeah, I've written four or five columns about Khodorkovsky. What first caught my eye was his incredibly moving, eloquent speech when he was about to be found guilty in the second bogus trial, which was last year. And when he said, you know, "I do not want to die, but there are some things that are worth dying for," I was thunderstruck. And the more I learned about his situation, the more I thought it raises such enormous questions about Russia and the rule of law. And you know, I used to be a business columnist before I became an op-ed columnist, and if you even see it just through the prism of business, you know, how can a country develop real businesses without a real rule of law? And they don't have a rule of law, they have a kleptocracy.
But when you were writing about business, were you aware of how business was being conducted in Russia and how the so-called oligarchs obtain the businesses they got?
Yes, and let me say something about that, Leonard. One of the things about this film that I think is really makes it stand out is it does not gloss over how the oligarchs got rich, and that includes Khodorkovsky. You know, it was a wild west out there, and there were really no rules, and you know, they got rich the same way Carnegie got rich. I mean, it was not pretty.
How much did Khodorkovsky pay for Yukos?
Well, you know, nobody really knows that. I mean, a lot of these companies, people were given scripts, and they went off and bought the scripts, and the scripts were essentially stock, and that's the way they distributed these companies. But Leonard, to me, to get hung up on that point is to miss the whole point of why Khodorkovsky matters. You know, Augustine was a sinner before he was a saint. And what Khodorkovsky represents now, he's not being punished for crimes that he may or may not have actually committed. He's being prosecuted and sent to jail on completely bogus claims because he ticked off Putin.
But Pavel, when the campaign against your father was being waged, many people pointed out that he had been able to pick up Yukos for just a tiny percentage of what it actually was worth. Okay, Sarah.
I could answer. What I heard, maybe you, I don't have that much proof that after 2000, Khodorkovsky even offered the state to give back a huge chunk of money to say, okay, guys, we had a big chance to buy all that stuff. Let's give the state back so that become eligible owners. And the state said no, and the other oligarchs also said no, because if you do this, then you are free of possibilities to put pressure on you. And my thing, what I learned now, even after the film is finished, that the only reason why he was punished is that he wanted to become free, to step out of the circle of guilt. Like, you know, the Tarantino film where everybody has a gun at the other's head, he wanted to get out of this circle. But Putin didn't allow it to him because he's a control freak. And if you're free out of this kompromat, you cannot be controlled.
Well, was he expected by the government to do certain things in exchange for purchasing Yukos well below the world market price? Was there an understanding between the government and these oligarchs that they wouldn't rock the boat, or that they would... it's suggested in the film that there are bribes and kickbacks that were being paid, even but that was all under the table. It wasn't official.
No, that understanding came later when Putin came to power, and it was very well... understood by the circle of most prominent oligarchs that if they stay out of politics, there will be no revision as to how the privatization of the state-run assets happened.
And your father agreed to that, didn't he?
My father agreed to that at the time by not openly arguing with the president. However, the actual issue that came up during that famous February meeting, February 2003, was not the revision of privatization. The issue was corruption. The issue that ticked off the conflict and started the conflict between my father and Putin, personal conflict, was that my dad pointed out that there was a huge corruption taking place right in the president's own backyard.
But Joe, didn't everybody know that corruption was a major part of the Russian system? It's also true of China, and it's true of countries all over the world, and it's true in this country as well.
Well,
maybe not the same way.
I'm going to have to disagree with you there. I mean,
we don't hear about politicians being paid bribes to do favors or to do historical research
and they go,
for
and
Fannie
they go,
Mae and things like that, Freddie Mae.
that's a genteel form of corruption. What does not happen in this country, Leonard, is that if a politician decides that he wants to enrich himself by taking over a company, he just makes up a new set of tax rules and says that they're in violation of them and takes it over. That's the difference. That is the fundamental difference.
So ex post facto, the tax laws were enacted, and then he was punished for not having lived by them before they were in place?
Leonard, in the second trial, he was accused of stealing every drop of oil that Yukos ever produced, personally.
Mm-hmm.
It's completely implausible. It makes no sense. And so, what really happened here was that Khodorkovsky, alone among the oligarchs, began to see that running his company on kind of Western principles made more sense for him as a big-time businessman. And so he began to do that, and part of that meant doing deals with Western companies like Exxon. And part of that, at the same time that was happening, he was also feeling empowered, maybe because he was so wealthy and maybe because he felt that Putin was the wrong person to be. He felt empowered to start acting more politically, which the other oligarchs did not do, and which Putin implicitly said, your right to your company is dependent on not crossing me. And Khodorkovsky thought, you know, for whatever reason, that he could stand up to that.
And Pavel, he started supporting the opposition party.
He did, because he thought that this was only a normal, natural way of developing the country's political system, that is to support both sides of the aisle, so to speak. And he did not think that this practice would upset the president that much,
well,
to put it mildly.
He didn't read Vladimir Putin very well, did he? But he was also, Joe suggested that he was seeing what was going on in the West, and where there's more transparency, at least theoretically more transparency, in business operations. And he was trying to do the same sort of thing in Russia?
Absolutely. Well, as Joe correctly pointed it out, my dad realized that the only way to grow value, to grow the value of the company beyond kind of how many resources it has and how many oil wells it drills, is to increase its transparency and attract foreign investment. That was only being possible. That would only be possible by opening the company up.
We're talking about a film called Khodorkovsky, which opens today at the Film Forum on West Houston Street with Pavel Khodorkovsky, the son of the subject of the film, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, also filmmaker Cyril Tushy, and Joe Nocera, who is a columnist for The New York Times and a contributor to WNYC. We will continue the conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Pavel Khodorkovsky. We're talking about his father, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who's the subject of Cyril Tushy's film that opens today at the Film Forum on West Houston Street. Also with us is Joe Nocera of the New York Times. And so here we are. Pavel, your father has now become one of the richest men in Russia, maybe the richest man in Russia, one of the richest people in the world. And he, at the same time, he decides to live rather modestly, or look like he's living rather modestly. Was he concerned about the fact that he had so much money?
No, he wasn't concerned about the mere fact that he had so much money. He was rather trying to live by whatever he thought he needs, rather than trying to live up to this stereotypical image of an oligarch. For example, we had this conversation with him when I was only about 13, I think, years old. And he told me that the amount of money that one requires to live comfortably in Russia is nowhere near the valuation that people place on his net worth. And he told me it was something like 300,000, which is well below even the comfortable salaries that managing directors at financial firms here in New York get.
But others said he was one of the three or four richest men in the world at the time. Yes, at least on paper?
Well, that was tied to the valuation of Yukos primarily, not to his personal wealth.
He created a gated community with some of the other people at Yukos. Was it gated because that's a excuse me, something that you'd expect in Russia, or because he also feared for his safety?
No, gated communities are actually very common, and it's just a matter of safety as opposed to a kind of manifestation of status.
Cyril, in 2000, Khodorkovsky changed the way he looked, the way he dressed. He shaved off his mustache, had his hair cut. Why did he do that?
100%, I don't know, of course, but I think it was a restart in many ways. And in the film, I reduced it to this to the beginning as an outer change. But of course, I know that there was more, and like maybe Pavel will say that he got also advice to do it. But I think he changed everything, how to run the company, and what was making sense on both ways for opening up for the West to develop educational programs, but also if you have a transparent company, you earn more money in the West because they rather buy these shares than other intransparent companies.
And he's presenting himself more like a Western businessman.
Well, I don't know whether that was done by his own liking or by somebody else's advice. But my dad, as you may see from the photographs dating back from that time, he was always dressing rather modestly. And actually, that question came up as possibly one of the reasons to why Putin disliked him so much. That is complete nonsense.
He jokes in the film that the reason that Putin went after him is because he showed up at a meeting without a tie. But that's unlikely. We see Putin without a tie, don't we? In fact, Putin likes to be photographed showing off his muscles.
With a bare chest. Exactly.
So,
but it could. I mean, if someone even if it's just one of the 12 theories, there's always a core, a little core in there that it is a conflict, power conflict, and who is at top of the game. Yeah.
So, Joe, do you think that everything would have been okay if Putin hadn't come to power? What kind of did his relationship with the government change after Putin came to power in 2000?
I think everything would have been okay if Putin had just let Khodorkovsky run Yukos the way he was running it. One of the tragedies here is that Yukos had the potential to lead the way to a different kind of capitalism in Russia. You got to understand that Russia has been badly, badly hurt by the in the post-Yukos era, by the impression, which is actually quite true, that the companies are not transparent, that politicians can make a grab for a company anytime they want, that there's all kinds of internal wheeling and dealing and accounting that is shady. And as a result of that, their stock market, the companies that go public get a much lower valuation. Foreign investors don't really go to Russia.
Joe. The sad thing is, I thought also, if you have as a warning for the foreign investments that if there's no rule of law, nobody will invest, they do invest. And I think they have a little Excel sheet and think, okay, what's on the bottom line? You invest something, maybe a state company steals 40%, but you still have so much growth that you do risk to invest. And they are so cynical. They just do it.
There is a huge discount. There's a huge discount for the companies and for the government, which is trying to get tax revenue for this. And Russia would be a much healthier country if Khodorkovsky had been allowed to continue to run Yukos the way in the direction that he was running it.
Do you think, to some degree, this is because of a certain deep-seated hostilities to the West still that we see in Russia? If you poll Russians, they still see America both to some degree in a positive light, but also as the chief rival of the country. Doing things the American way might be considered to be too un-Russian.
It's very much propaganda, I think. I mean, people who travel, they know better. And Pavel is very American already.
That's certainly true.
Are you seen as too American, Pavel, when you go back?
I actually haven't been back since 2003.
Are you afraid? Would you be arrested? Are you likely to
I don't
be
want
vulnerable?
To be. I don't want to become another problem for my father. That's why I don't go back. But possibly, I can see myself being perceived as, well, too American.
In 2003, during a televised meeting at the Kremlin, your father openly challenged Putin. He was breaking the deal, wasn't he, that the oligarchs would not give, would just go along with Putin and not be critical?
Well, he wasn't.
What led to that?
He wasn't breaking the deal at that time about non-financing the opposition. The issue at the table was acquisition of a small oil company, Severnaya Neft, which was bought for almost twice its value by the state-run Rosneft. Mm-hmm. And my dad was just pointing out that clearly there was a kickback in the amount of close to $300 million.
Yeah, but he's saying this in front of Putin in a public setting, and I don't know if there's a Russian word that's the equivalent of chutzpah, but that when I saw him do that, Cyril, I thought, oh, what does he think he's doing here?
I mean, there's still some riddles for this day, because I heard that someone else was supposed to make the speech against corruption, and he didn't want. He was chickening out, and someone, I think Voloshin, said, do it. And there's still a theory that Voloshin and Abramovich even set up a trap for Khodorkovsky. that he was running into that. I'm not sure about, but I heard that, yeah.
I don't know whether there was a full disclosure on Voloshin's part as to how he thought president would react to this, but there was this widespread understanding that the issue of corruption needs to be brought up, and it so happened that my dad decided to voice it. But it was a wider understanding that this needs to be addressed.
I was just wondering, Joe, if somebody of a business person were televising a meeting with top American politicians and said, you know, there's a lot of corruption here, and maybe, Mr. President, you're getting some of that money, whether that person would be punished on some level, maybe not sent off to the gulag, but you'd pay a price for that, wouldn't you?
I think you'd pay a – you wouldn't get invited back. It might be harder to get federal subsidies if you were in those kind of businesses. I don't think the yes, it would not be kosher, and most U.S. businessmen don't do it, but wouldn't do a thing like that. But there are certainly a lot of businessmen out there railing about Obama, maybe not to his face, but they're certainly doing it with no consequence. And I don't really agree with the notion that there's a kind of an equivalence here. I think what Khodorkovsky did at that moment was very brave, and I think one of the things that we need to focus on after all the time he spent in prison is the number of things that he did leading up to his arrest that were, in fact, brave, including not fleeing Russia, as many of the other oligarchs did.
And I wanted to ask about that. Before he was arrested, his number two man, Platon Lebedev, was arrested. And then he came and visited you, Pavel, in the United States. Did you talk about him staying here?
Well, no, we actually talked about him going back very briefly. He stated it as a matter of fact that he's going back. I didn't feel a single note of doubt in his voice when he said that. So I didn't challenge him. I regret it, obviously.
You were in school at the time?
Yes, it was my freshman year in college.
Cyril, did Putin ever offer Khodorkovsky a way to avoid going to jail, as been suggested?
I put something in of Irina Yasina that I heard that there were several warnings, of course, before the arrest. That's what I heard, several. And I heard of Temerko, vice president of Yugos, that he knew even before the arrest when the arrest will be, which is strange. You know? And after that, after the arrest, I heard of many offers. If you say I'm guilty and I will never criticize Putin and I will never invest in politics again, then you will get out immediately. That he declined these offers.
They also offered to give him a lot of money if he would leave.
Well, something like, no, this I don't know. No.
Now, Joe, what's happened to Yugos? Who owns it now? Joe, are you there?
Yeah, Yugos Asket, somebody just walked into my hotel room, sorry. I had to explain that I was on the Leonard Lopez show and he immediately left. Assets were... quote-unquote, sold to another Russian state-run oil company called Rosneft. Mm-hmm. They are now known as those assets are now known as the crown jewels of Rosneft. Now, one of the interesting things here, Leonard, is that...
Well, who's running Rosneft? Is that another oligarch, or is it there the government involved in that?
No, the government's heavily involved in that. I mean, it's fundamentally a state-run enterprise, as is Gazprom, as is any number of the other truly important energy companies. The people who are running it are very wealthy, but, you know, they're not the same kind of, cowboy capitalist that the old oligarchs were. Now, Rosneft is going to try and have a public offering fairly soon, I think. I don't know what the date is. And the point of this is that the government is trying to raise money. And so here they are coming to the United States and to Europe with their crown jewel, i.e. stolen assets from Yugos, saying to American and European investors, hey, come on, invest with us.
Now, he has been resentenced. He was about to be released if he had served out his full term, and they just have resentenced him. Do you think this is going to continue? Is that your sense? Or do you think that they'll figure after 14 years he'll have been punished enough?
My family has been really looking forward to the 25th of October of last year because it,
that's when he was to be released.
Yes, but unfortunately, at that time, we already had another proceeding going on. The 8 years anniversary would have actually, and the date of his release would have been this year. But by the 25th of October, the second trial was well underway last year in 2010, and by the 30th of December, he was already sentenced to an additional 14 years. So now, some of that sentence that he has served in the first trial was accounted for. So he's due date to be released now is 2016.
Now, the film, we've run out of time, but your film suggests, Cyril, that Russians believe that he's guilty as charged.
Russians believe he's guilty as charged?
Well, yeah, you ask a bunch of people, and they say, oh, yeah, he embezzled money.
Well, the point is, I was, of course, coming from Europe, also very much shocked that so many people think that and don't support Khodorkovsky. And I think it's just a matter of propaganda. That's it.
Well, I have to thank you all for being with us. By the way, I want to point out that Pavel is also involved in Russian Visionaries, an exhibit, Into the Light, which opens tomorrow at the 25 Central Park West Gallery. And my great thanks to you, Pavel Khodorkovsky, to Cyril Tushy, the filmmaker responsible for the film called Khodorkovsky, which opens today at the Film Forum, and to Joe Nocera of the New York Times and WNYC. Thank you all.
Thanks.